This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Barry Eidlin from McGill University. Barry just published Labor and the Class Idea in the United States and Canada with Cambridge University Press. It's a pleasure to have him join us. Thank you for joining us, Barry.
Glad to be here, Joe.
So tell us about Labor and the Class Idea. What's it about?
So it's basically about the question of why unions are weaker in the US than they are in Canada, but haven't always been that way. So there've been a lot of stories in the media about the decline of the US labor movement. It currently stands at about 1 in 10 workers are members of unions, only about 6% when you're talking about the private sector. Whereas if we look north, to Canada, it's about 30%, or well, it's 28%, about three times higher. So that's current day. And basically what I start off with is this idea that, but if you look at the data historically, US and Canadian unionization rates were virtually identical for much of the 20th century up until around the mid-1960s, and there's this great divergence. So the book is an attempt to explain why you get that divergence.
Well, before we even get into the why, why does unionization matter? Aren't these just relics of institutions with no impact?
Yes, so that's a question that does come up. And there's several reasons why they matter. So first of all, if we just are looking at the economics, there's a lot of research in economics these days that is sort of looking at labor markets and talking about the role that what's called monopsony power. So basically when you have one seller and one buyer and many sellers has in basically, you know, distorting the labor market. So basically monopsony power. So we often think about it like Walmart or something like that and their suppliers, but it also works when we're talking about an employer and potential employees. When they have a much greater power over, you know, who they can buy from, there's an inherent power imbalance there. And so unions' ability to sort of collectively bargain for individual workers does create a situation that helps to reduce the role of monopsony power, basically. So that's the sort of basic economics 101 reason.
Okay. So I have a quick question about that. So
yeah, sure.
That doesn't seem consistent with the large firm premium. So, you know, there's an empirical generality, stylized fact, whatever you want to call it, that large firms almost always pay more than small firms. But a large firm should have more monopsony power in the labor market than a small firm. A small firm should be a price taker in the labor market, not a price setter. Whereas a large firm theoretically could be, but the large firms pay more.
Yeah, I think that this is mainly what we're talking about at the local level, when we're talking about local labor markets and how they work. Right. And I think that, and also, I mean, the other part of it is that, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why larger firms pay more. One of them also being that they tend to be more, that you tend to find more unions there. So there is a union wage premium and that is, you know, unequally distributed among smaller and larger employers. So there's the economic argument. I mean, basically the basic economic argument is that unions are a key institution that reduces wage inequality, and there's a variety of reasons for that. There's also a political argument to be made in the sense that unions are one of the few organizations in contemporary society that are organized by and for the interests of workers. You know, there's been all that stuff about the decline of civic associationism and that kind of thing. But this is really one of the big stories in the sense that there are very few mechanisms that ordinary workers have for expressing their political views in the political sphere. And unions are a way of organizing those those preferences, essentially, into the political sphere. Now they provide a way of deliberating because there's no sort of easy way to sort of aggregate those preferences. You know, it's not a preference aggregating machine. It requires sort of a negotiation process, right? And so, and it's not that it's some perfect institution, but it at least provides an instrument for making that happen. Absent that, basically, most workers end up, you know, basically excluded from the political sphere, certainly as workers. So basically, as unions have declined over the past, you know, 40, 50 years, we've had an increase in economic inequality, and we've had a sort of decline in the ability of workers to make their voice heard in the political sphere. And so those are the two big reasons that we should be caring about union decline.
Yeah, so I just have a small qualification there, which is that you were describing it as aggregating their preferences. I would have no problem with the...
Well, as not...
I'm sorry. Well, how would you prefer to describe it?
As... Well, no, I mean, what I'm saying is that workers have all sorts of multiple and overlapping sure. preferences based on what they are and all that stuff. And so what I'm saying precisely is that there is no way to just sort of add up those preferences and sort of like toss them into the political sphere, that there has to be a process of deliberation essentially about what we're prioritizing and in what way. And so anyway, so that's what I was saying about the impossibility of just aggregating.
Okay. I was just going to say, I'd have no problem with describing as, you know, representing collective interests. Preferences strikes me as mm-hmm. a more loaded term, particularly as there's been litigation over people who object to their own union, but we can just bracket that and kind of, because it's obviously not the core of your, what you're interested in.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, but you know what? It is. It's I read it as kind of being close to the core because, Barry, you said that unions were very strong in the United States several decades ago. But now we are in a position where even people who could be organized are more hostile towards the notion of unions. In fact, there you talk about or you seem to suggest there's a more of a generalized hostility towards organized labor. What happened?
Well, I would distinguish between generalized hostility and the specific hostility of employers. So if you just look at general population data, you know, if you look at Gallup polls, unions have polled, you know, the union approval has consistently been above 50% for as long as they've done the polls. Absolute majorities of Americans approve of unions. And that number has, you know, fluctuated up and down, but not really nearly, not by much, and certainly nowhere near the way the actual unionization rate has changed. What has changed is sort of I wouldn't say change, but where the hostility is amongst employers. And I think that there's a lot of research that shows the sort of distinctive hostility of American employers towards unions. There's a variety of reasons of that we can talk about. I somewhat take issue with that because there's also plenty of evidence that shows that Canadian employers had a similar level of hostility, but the institutional environment essentially kept that in check. So basically, the institutional environment in the U.S. has let that hostility be more fully expressed.
Can you flesh that out a bit for us? Like, what do you mean when you say the institutional environment is more favorable towards unions? What makes up that institutional environment?
So the basic problem in the U.S. is that the labor laws in the U.S. have been essentially reduced to a dead letter, such that employers, basically doing a straight cost-benefit analysis, can calculate that the benefits of resisting unions, firing workers, engaging in all sorts of illegal practices that are, you know, against the laws, even if they're found guilty of violating those laws, the delays involved in adjudicating those cases, and even if they're found guilty, the eventual penalties are trivial compared to the benefits they get from resisting the union. Mm. And whereas in Canada, the legal framework is similar. It has some key differences nowadays, but basically keeps that employer resistance in check and basically increases the penalty for. I can give you some one example.
Sure.
If you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
Is basically in terms of once you certify a union in a workplace, there is an additional hurdle that in the US and Canadian labor law framework, where because the union is decided at the workplace, at the firm or workplace level, rather than industry level as is done in other countries, there's like another key hurdle to jump over, which is negotiating that first collective bargaining, that first contract, the first collective bargaining agreement. Now, in the US, if the employer can basically drag that process out for up to a year and basically convince the workers that, you know, you're basically not going to get anywhere with us. This whole union thing is just not worth your time. Basically drag it out for a year. They can then convince some group of workers to file a decertification petition and get rid of the union. Hmm. In Canada, most provinces in Canada have what's called first contract arbitration, which means that at the end of a given period, usually around a year, but it varies by province, if the union and the company have not reached an agreement, that contract gets kicked to an arbitrator who then imposes a first agreement. Now, in reality, that almost never happens. But the fact that that is the end point, rather than the possibility of decertification being the end point, means that employers are much more incentivized to bargain with the union in Canada than they are in the United States.
So I have a question. Sure. I mean, we've been seeing the decline of unions in not just in terms of membership, but I think in many ways in terms of the power of unions in this country for decades. And but I've been struck by the teacher strikes that have been happening across the country and their effectiveness, struck by two things. Number one, their level of effectiveness, but number two, why there aren't more.
So. Yeah, well, I think that you're starting to see more, right? I mean, right now, as we speak, there's about 12,000 workers out in the University of California system that are on strike. There's strikes spreading to Colorado. There's more stuff happening in Kentucky. So there's a lot more going on. And this is very much in keeping with how unions have grown over time, which is not in the sort of incremental growth pattern, but rather these growth spurts, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it tells us a lot about how labor might turn things around, right? Because we've been, like you said, we've been hearing about unions decline and, you know, demise for many decades now, in the same way that, you know, in 1932 or so, you know, the presidents of the American Economic Association are always known for these ill-timed comments, right? There's that comment about the Great Depression, right? But then there's another one about in 1932 about how unions are basically sort of dead and have served their purpose. And then, you know, 1934, there's a massive strike wave that basically transforms the entire country. So, there's historical precedents for this. But I think that it shows the importance of that we can't, even at 10%, unions are still a powerful potential source of power for workers. And that's what we're seeing in these teacher strikes, is that they create an organizational infrastructure that people can plug into. So a lot of these teachers, particularly in these states like West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, which are right-to-work states, meaning that most workers are not obligated to join the union. A lot of these strikers are not union members, right? Yeah. They just get plugged into this infrastructure, right? And so when you have that in place, it gives a vehicle for people to mobilize. And that's really important, even if at a given moment in time, it's in this kind of dilapidated, rundown state, the way that these teachers' unions have been, right? And it shows the power that these movements have in not only winning these key immediate demands, but actually in creating sort of these new organizational infrastructures that can help win more gains further down the line.
Well, you were saying it shows a way forward in kind of a punctuated equilibrium sense of sudden bursts of growth. But, you know, the other way to view it is that this is a public sector union strike. And, you know, in the United States since, I don't know, when public sector unionization really took off. I think it was the late
1960s.
Yeah, I was going to say the late 60s. I think Kennedy was actually the one who legalized it. That, you know, we've had this trend where unionization has kind of gone into a public sector ghetto, and to a certain, and also, you know, large nonprofit organizations like hospitals that for all practical purposes are part of the state. And so in that respect, it's not showing a, you know, how's this opportunity for growth. It's saying, how do you further mine the niche that you're already in?
Yeah,
go ahead, please.
Yeah. So no, I think that that's a great point that people bring up all the time, is that, you know, these are sort of public sector workers. And I think it's important to challenge the stark divide that we create between public and private sector, particularly when you're thinking about, for two reasons. First of all, when you're thinking about, you know, public education, when you're thinking about, and particularly healthcare, which are two of the main sources of employment, right? I mean, if you're looking at sort of where employment is concentrated nowadays, when we're thinking about service sector shift, a lot of that is shift to employment like the education sector and healthcare. And so, but the thing about those is that they really straddle the public-private divide in a lot of important ways, particularly nowadays when you're getting these layers of subcontractors and that kind of thing, right? So first of all, it's sort of, if we create this stark separation, it's largely an artificial one. The second point, which is more important, I think, from a mobilizing perspective, is that these public sector workers live in communities. And these are communities that are made up of people who work for government agencies and for private employers. And when you have these mobilizations, like we've had in West Virginia and in Oklahoma and Arizona and all these other states, that creates an example of what is possible, right? And so I think that one of the things that that, you know, because that's certainly what these teachers are saying. When you talk to the teachers and you look at these interviews, they are learning from each other. And it often has a sort of demonstration effect in, you know, across the broader, you know, community, right? And it happens in the other direction too, right? I mean, you just think in the opposite direction about the way that Act 10 in Wisconsin, which was targeted at state employees, had these knock-on effects in the private sector. You think about
Can
Reagan.
Can you remind us what that bill did?
Okay, yes. So Act 10 in Wisconsin was this bill passed by Governor Scott Walker that basically deprived public sector workers of effective collective bargaining. It basically reduced all they could bargain to. Was the question of wages, and they were forbidden from negotiating any wage increase above the rate of inflation. And they also subjected them to annual recertification votes that required a majority of workers in the workplace, not just a majority of voters, to affirmatively vote in favor of the union. And so that basically contributed to this catastrophic decline in union membership. But then a few years later, it also set the stage for a right-to-work law in Wisconsin that has also, you know, had negative effects in the private sector, right? So there's been this sort of so what happens in amongst government employees has effects on private sector workers and vice versa.
Okay, so I appreciate you saying like, oh, these things bleed into each other and everything like that, but we still face this basic fact that private, as you said in your introduction, that private sector unionization has had this long run collapse. When did it peak? Like the mid 30s or something like that?
The peak was in the 50s.
The 50s. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Even after the first wave of right to work in the 40s.
Okay. Wait, Barry, was it, that's in proportion though, right? Wasn't it in absolute numbers it started shedding in the 80s?
Well, yes, you actually started getting a decline in the absolute number in the late 70s and early 80s, particularly with the Volcker recession in the early 80s.
Okay, so as a proportion of workers, it's been declining since the 50s. In the private sector, And mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, we crossed the line where it's now a majority in the public sector. So I appreciate exactly. everything you're saying about people live in communities, mm-hmm. that there's spillovers and things like that. But it's still a big, empirical finding, like, or stylized factor, whatever you want to say it, that we see it shifting by sector. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean it's legitimate or illegitimate or anything like that. I'm not making a normative point at all. I'm just saying mm-hmm. it's interesting, yeah. right? That you see absolutely. it's not almost entirely, but the trend is all towards it being a public sector, to the extent that you have pretty high unionization rates in the public sector and mm-hmm. very low rates in the private sector. So just one simple question, and then you can address, like, why is that shift? What is the public versus private sector unionization in Canada?
It's a similar divide, the ratio. So it's roughly 2-1. It's basically about, 30% versus 7% in the US, and it's about 18% private versus about 70-something% public in Canada.
Interesting.
So you have that huge gap between public and private sector in Canada as well, but the ratio of the public-private gap is similar in both countries.
Interesting. Now, could you tell us why there was a decline in the private sector? I mean, you told us a little in that, the states doesn't set the institutions of negotiation in a relatively favorable way for the union, but why? So I guess that helps explain the private sector decline. You kind of already answered that, but why the public sector increase?
Well, there is basically a huge social movement explosion in the 1960s that completely shifted the terrain around public sector collective bargaining. That's the short answer. I mean, prior, the thing that we have to remember, so nowadays, people say, public sector, it's so much easier to organize there. I mean, prior to the 1960s, the idea of public sector unionism was considered beyond the pale amongst a lot. So Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who passed the Wagner Act, had these quotes that current opponents of public sector unions love to trot out about, how the idea of public sector unionism is just completely anathema to a modern democracy. In Canada, one of the premier of Quebec in the early 60s, when the sort of initial movements were getting on, famously said that the queen does not bargain with her subjects. When these public sector unions were getting off the ground. So basically, the institutional environment shifted in response to a massive social mobilization in both the US and Canada in the 1960s that basically established public sector collective bargaining as more of a norm.
Okay, so to think about it in counterfactual terms, you mm-hmm. told us that private sector employers have very strong incentives to resist unionization. And that's mm-hmm. true in both the US and Canada, but the best alternative to a negotiated agreement is skewed towards the union in Canada and skewed towards the employer in the United States. But why is that not true? And this is kind of a rhetorical question because I can guess, but why is that not true in the public sector, right? If I'm a school superintendent, why am I not, why don't I have the same incentives as if I own a small factory to fight like hell to stall and then repeal or whatever the union?
Yeah, I mean, this is, not a huge point in the book, but I mean, I think that the basic idea is that, public sector employment is governed by a whole bunch of other regulations aside from, compared to the private sector. And so most public employees are covered by some form of civil service, employment guidelines or what have you, that set and a certain benefits packages and what have you that are sort of set regardless of whether or not you have a collective bargaining agreement in place.
Well, also as a practical matter, the voters are the ultimate decision makers in government,
yes.
and a lot of workers will be part of that constituency,
correct.
Right? Whereas business owners aren't accountable
exactly
to their
yeah.
workers, unless yeah, the government.
That's probably,
yeah, so those are the
so there's it's a completely different interest.
Yeah, and I also And I was going to say, I mean, it's also a nature of, I mean, if I think about teachers in particular, I mean, they have a certain skill set and there's a teacher shortage. And so, and there has been historically for a long time. So, in that respect, even a weak union, given that shortage of labor, I think has a lot of leverage.
And I think it's not just a shortage of labor, but it's a shortage of skilled labor. There's a great ASR from 2013 by Howard Kimmeldorf. I got to give a shout out to Howard Kimmeldorf. and it's about this concept of worker replacement costs as a key driver of union growth. And so when you have the groups of workers that are most likely to be the sort of leaders of these union upsurges are these workers that have high replacement costs. And in this case, what we're seeing are these teachers are the ones with the high replacement costs.
So Barry, you're saying that America and Canada were quite similar decades ago, and there was a divergence. Can you tell us why that happened?
Yeah. So basically, there's a bunch of factors that people think are going on, like the labor law example that I was talking about, that Canada has better labor law. Canada has a more positive attitude towards unions. Canada is just more social democratic, or those kind of things. And really, the first part of the book is this sort of systematic evaluation of all those things that we think the answer is and showing the limitations of that. And the answer that I articulate in the book is that it really is this sort of paradoxical outcome of the way that ruling parties in the US and Canada responded to the worker upsurge of the 1930s and 40s. And what the paradoxical thing is that it's actually the more positive pro-union response of Roosevelt and the New Deal administration that laid the groundwork for labor's long-term weakness and decline in the US, whereas a more hostile anti-union response in Canada ultimately paved the way for a stronger labor law regime and a stronger Canadian labor movement.
So what are the main lessons that you think we can walk away from this study?
So the first thing is that unions still matter. I think that's sort of a basic point, an empirical point to make. You know, if there's all this growing concern about, growing economic inequality that a lot of sociologists care about. And I think that this union decline piece is a key part of that puzzle that we need to be thinking about more. And I think that, but the big thing that my book is contributing to that debate is that I think that a lot of the discussion, there's been hand-wringing about union decline for a long time, and a lot of this talk about how to turn it around, and it's been focused on these technical fixes like labor law reform. So, the first few years of the Obama administration was the last round of this, but, whether it's labor law reform, whether it's sort of getting more Democrats elected who can then sort of be, more favorable towards unions or what have you. And really, the title of the book is Labor and the Class Idea. And I think that what the fundamental take home is that any plan for turning labor's fortunes around needs to focus on reviving that class idea in the US. And by that, I mean the idea that sort of a working class identity that is sort of inclusive, expansionary, and is expansive, not expansionary. Inclusive and expansive, not the sort of narrow idea of working class meaning blue collar white men. That as a legitimate sort of social and political category in society in a way that it is not in the current political scenario. And I think that going back to the point earlier about the teacher strikes is that that's sort of what we're seeing. That's sort of one of the promising things that we're seeing in this strike wave is that these teachers are not explicitly not just fighting for their own narrow self-interest. Like, yes, they are fighting for higher wages for themselves, but they're also fighting for the bus drivers, for the cafeteria workers, for all the categories. And they're also fighting for things like increased school funding. They're forcing these Republican governors to sign tax increases into law for the first time in decades, you know, and to basically commit to funding public education. And so they're making these demands that are not just for themselves, but for broader working class demands. And the, and so I think that that is really the fundamental lesson to take away from the book in terms of sort of where we go from here.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.